As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to Success Story, the most useful podcast in the world. I'm your host, Scott D. Clary. The Success Story podcast is part of the Blue Wire podcast network, as well as the HubSpot podcast network. Now, the HubSpot podcast network has incredible shows like The Hustle Daily. It's hosted by Zachary Crockett, Jacob Cohen, Rob Litterst, and Juliet Bennett Ryla. Now, The Hustle Daily brings you a healthy dose of irreverent, offbeat, and informative takes on business, tech, and news. And it happens daily. So if you want to stay up to date on the latest and greatest, and some of these topics are interesting to you, then you're going to love The Hustle Daily. Topics like Amazon's grocery strategy, the rise of the ugly shoe economy, is AI the secret to love, and America's sleep deficit problem. So if these are topics you want to get into and you love hearing up-to-date content whenever you wake up in the morning, go listen to The Hustle Daily wherever you listen to your podcast. Today, my guest is David Siegel. He is the CEO of Meetup. He's overseeing Meetup's global business. They have 52 million members. They host 15,000 events daily in 193 countries. As a business leader and expert in building personal and professional communities, he also hosts a podcast, Keep Connected, and he is the author of the best-selling book, Decide and Conquer, 44 Decisions That Will Make or Break All Leaders. He has 20 years experience leading technology and digital media organizations focused on community healthcare and finance. He has a significant background in innovative product development, rapid revenue growth, and digital traffic acceleration. This is evident by his work at Meetup. In his first 18 months, he brought the social media platform to its most profitable state in the company's 18-year history. In March of 2020, he oversaw its acquisition from WeWork, that had previously acquired Meetup, to a consortium of investors led by Alicorp. From 2015 to 2018, he was the CEO of Investopedia. He 5X'd their growth, and he led them through a successful merger of Investopedia to Dotdash. Previous to that, he served as president of Seeking Alpha, a crowdsourced investment research business with more than 4 million registered users. Between president, general manager, chief executive, he has had five leadership roles, chief executive, decision-making roles in large organizations. So he's had an incredible career. What did we speak about? Well, we spoke about lessons in leadership and business that he has learned over his career through stories, that he's experienced some ups, some downs, how he's applied them to the various organizations that he's worked at. Most recently, some very tactical stories of how he's applied some leadership lessons that we discussed to Meetup, where he's obviously currently CEO. We spoke about principles of open communication, radical candor, transparency, kindness to inform great decision-making. We spoke about types of biases and how they impact an organization, four types in particular, and how to overcome them and how to make sure that your decision-making process doesn't succumb to these biases. We spoke about how to hire executives. He's done it a lot. The most important and least important things to look for when hiring executives. We spoke about his decision-making process to make effective, speedy, meaningful, and hopefully correct decisions. And we also spoke about his prioritization and deprioritization framework, which is ultimately the most important framework that he deploys to be successful and to decide what he should even focus on, let alone make those decisions. So some great business stories, some lessons, some very tactical things based on all these different leadership lessons that he's learned over his career and how he actually executes them in Meetup. So if you want to learn from a really great tenured executive, you want to learn how he operates his business today, this is a great show. Let's jump right into it. This is David Siegel. He is the CEO of Meetup.
I was born in a small log cabin in Kentucky. Don't worry, we'll get a lot faster now. I was not born in a log cabin in Kentucky, but I was born in Kentucky on an army base in Kentucky. Now let's fast forward. Grew up in the New York metro area, upper middle class, amazing parents, incredibly lucky to have the loving household that we grew up in. Had really like the standard high school experience where I was kind of like a little nerdy, but not nerdy enough to be like super duper smart, but nerdy enough to hang out with the people who were really smart and okay in sports, enough to hang out with people who are really, really good in sports, but always like at the lower end of each of those different areas. And maybe that's why I became like a particularly competitive person. But anyway, I would say the most important, probably professional opportunity that I had in life was after graduating college. I worked in consulting and my biggest client was DoubleClick. Now, DoubleClick at the time, most people don't know this unless they're like 35 or above. DoubleClick was the internet website. All advertising came through DoubleClick. Most advertising on the internet came through DoubleClick. Made the internet free. Google acquired DoubleClick for like $3 billion. And over 200 different CEOs of internet companies have come from DoubleClick. So I was very lucky at about 24 years old to become a director, actually, at DoubleClick. And I did that. And that one experience when I was really quite young, a couple years out of college, had an impact in my life to fast forward, and I could rewind back a little bit to when I became CEO of Meetup and WeWork was imploding and WeWork owned Meetup. The person who I went back to 20 years later after having built the relationship was the CEO of DoubleClick at the time to acquire Meetup out of WeWork. So I could fill in the gaps in the middle. But a lot comes down to kind of those early experiences that I had. And then just, you know, the quick bio is I was at one point president of a site called Seeking Alpha, one of the largest financial education sites. And then I became the CEO of Investopedia for about 4 years. We sold that company. And then Adam Neumann came knocking on my door for WeWork. And it was an opportunity I couldn't refuse. And that's the origin.
Dude, that's an awesome story. And you've done a lot too. So. Where do you want to, what would be some of the most interesting pre-meetup stories? You can pick a few. I know there's a lot. Investopedia, WeWork, those are names that people know. And plus probably some at DoubleClick too. So pick some fun stories that I would say were like key points, defining points in your career, that allowed you to speak to some of the things that you speak to in your book, some of the leadership lessons. Those were not just thought up overnight. So there's things that you learn, there's people you worked with, there's good times, there's bad times for sure. So go into some stories. I love
stories. We'll do a good story and we'll do a challenging story. So we'll do both of those.
All right, deal.
Take it from there. Good story. So after DoubleClick, I decided to go to business school and I was in Wharton for business school and I didn't want to do the standard like investment banking consulting thing because just that's boring. I had a dream job. And my dream job was to become the assistant to a CEO. To be like the right-hand person, not to get the coffee or whatever it is, but like to work on board decks and work on strategy and just learn from really, really smart people. So one night in business school, a couple months before graduation, I decided I was going to go on a blitzkrieg of like sending out insane numbers of emails. I stayed up all night. I kid you not, I figured out what the email addresses were for all these different companies, like at D Siegel, David.Siegel, David_Siegel, whatever the email address happens to be. And I sent about 10,000 emails to every executive for about of 100 different companies and said, I want to become the assistant to the CEO. Great. I ended up having conversations through that with and connections with David Stern, the commissioner of the NBA National Basketball Association at the time, Ken Chenault, the CEO of American Express, all these just like illuminate, David Neilman, the CEO of JetBlue, all these companies that like were amazing companies. And I couldn't get the role of becoming an assistant CEO. I tried, didn't work out. Okay, fast forward, I took another job. 3 years later, I also spoke to the CEO of 1-800-Flowers. Fast forward 3 years later, there was a posting on the Wharton alumni database. And the posting said, 1-800-Flowers looking for an assistant to the CEO. And I was like, wait, 3 years ago, I spoke to Jim McCann, the founder and CEO of 180 Flowers, and I begged him to become the assistant. He's like, I don't need an assistant. So I sent him an email. This is 3 years after graduating from business school. And I said, hey, we haven't talked in 3 years, but I just, if I in any way influence your decision to decide to hire an assistant for a CEO, then I would love to, you know, get together sometime. So he emails me back five like amazing words. And the five words were, I was looking for you.
That's so funny.
It was
funny.
Like a Harry Met Sally kind of moment thing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's that's a lesson in and of itself. That, you know, like how everybody gets somewhere in life. There's this book by Alex Banyan, and he interviewed a whole bunch of like executives. Like he interviewed, I'm blanking on the names now, but like very, very notable people. And there's always like this third door. Like there's like the front way and the back way that you can get something done. And then there's like the third door, like the other opportunity where like people like think outside the box and figure it out. This is what you're doing. This is exactly what you're doing.
This sounds surprising, but there's not a single job that I've gotten. I've had seven jobs that existed beforehand.
I love
every job was like a job I created, except for a CEO role that kind of had existed beforehand because companies need CEOs, right? So, but it's the reason why I think there's an illustrative comment in terms of decision making is number one, when you're making decisions, you have to think about how are you creating options for yourself? Are you limiting the number of options for yourself and making a decision? Now you have fewer things that could happen to you in the future. Or are you creating options for yourself that could end up resulting in you just getting lucky at some point in time? And I actually believe, as crazy as it sounds, that you can create your own luck by making decisions and having enormous numbers of volumes of conversation, that lucky stuff just ends up kind of like happening to you. And people are like, oh my God, you're so lucky. I can't believe it. Well, am I lucky? Yes. But I also had 10,000 little points out there that would create situations where I could end up becoming lucky. So how do you make decisions that create many different options for yourself so that luck ends up happening to you?
Smart. Very smart. Okay. So that was great. So that's a good story. So how did that work out? Where did that place you after the assistant to the CEO? Did you take it?
So it changed my career, honestly. So I met with him. He ended up hiring me, not for that role, a made up role called Vice President of Strategic Initiatives, which is usually like some person on their way out of life. Title. Like, we don't know what to do with you. So you're going to be a Vice President of Strategic Initiatives. Oh no. What does that mean? But I was like early days. So I did that. And they're like, we'll just figure out what you're going to do. And by the end of 4.5 years at 180 Flowers, I was running all mergers and acquisitions for the company, a lot of shared marketing services, international operations, just a whole bunch of other things that, you know, just kind of took on over time. So it really helped to make my career and was great, incredible. great opportunity to learn from some very smart people. Okay. Now I'll tell you I mean, I have so many like crappy stories.
Okay. So if I have to just ask, is the bad story a WeWork story?
Whatever you want. I got lots.
I don't know. I figured there was a story with WeWork.
Oh my God.
Like there's not a story.
No, I got like 100 stories for WeWork. Okay. Here's a story for WeWork. So, this is a crazy story. So I was running Meetup. And WeWork had been acquired by WeWork in late 2018. And everyone at Meetup had WeWork stock. That's the only stock that they had when I came in. And WeWork stock had gone up to a valuation of $47 billion. And, you know, come late 2019, early 2020, we start seeing like these articles in Wall Street Journal of like, down now with 40 billion, now we're 30 billion, now we're 20 billion, now we're 10 billion. And we're like, I don't know if I can say this, but the shit's going to fall down and it's going to fall on little Meetup. We know this is going to happen. So, and I kept being assured, don't worry, David, it's not going to impact Meetup. It's everything's going to be fine. And I was like, come on, we know that like, it's not going to be fine. So I was also coincidentally, it's kind of a random thing for like the death of a company. I was actually visiting my father's grave. Once a year, I visit him in a cemetery and I get a call and the call says, David is about to hit the Wall Street Journal that meetup is for sale. Just total surprise. No forewarning, no nothing. And I'm like, oh my God, if our employees, our 200 plus employees, hear about this for the first time from the Wall Street Journal and from their friends, well, that's a great way for me to, for them to lose all trust in me, because they're not going to believe that I didn't know about it. They're going to think I knew about it, I hid it from them, and every time I try to convince them of something, you know, they're going to be surprised. I hoofed it to Meetup. I quickly got a senior person at WeWork to meet me there, so they knew it was legit. Called all of our employees for an emergency meeting. I started telling them that, you know, Meetup is about to be for sale. Within like 3 minutes of the conversation, every person's phone is like buzzing because it hit the Wall Street Journal.
You just caught it.
And we just caught it in time. And that's, you know, one story, but I've got many other Adam Newman, crazy, you know, plane ride experiences or whatever that's out there as well.
Yeah, no, definitely. Okay, so then that was a difficult situation. What was the most notable negative or difficult time in your career that shaped you?
Yeah. I had an experience in my career where I was like semi-catatonic in how deeply disturbing it was. So here's the experience. And it definitely helped to shape me. So prior to Meetup, I was the CEO of Investopedia. Okay. Investopedia is owned by IAC. The chairman of IAC is a very famous individual, Barry Diller. The CEO of IAC is Joey Levin. And I worked for them. We had an amazing success in Investopedia. I joined the company, was doing $11 million. And ended up 4 years later doing $35 million in revenue. So over tripled in size. One day, a senior executive, I won't say who, came into my office after 4.5 years being there. And he said, David, we just sold Investopedia. And I was like, wait. I'm the CEO.
How did you do that
with no due diligence, without any companies wanting to talk to like the executive team? Who bought us? What happened? And like, don't worry, David, we're going to take care of you. We got a really, really good price for it. And you're going to be happy financially. I'm like, no, forget the financial thing. Like, what happened here? And basically a sister company of IAC called Dotdash convinced IAC to acquire Investopedia. They knew our business because it was all part of the same umbrella brand. And that was it. I was out with just complete and total surprise. And we were just like at the top of a mountain at the time. And I think they actually, IAC, to their credit, did do above and beyond appropriate things for me and for others. And they also offered me to stay on at IAC corporate as in another role, and another executive position. But I was so in total shock and surprised. The reason why that really did impact me is because I swore kind of after that experience that the number one job of a CEO and of a leader is not to surprise people. Your job is not to surprise your employees. Your job is not to surprise your board, because having been surprised actually numerous times in my career now, it's so painful. Because it's not about the experience of being surprised. That's hard. But it's about the loss of trust that you have in people whom you trusted previously, and they weren't able to be upfront with you for whatever reason it happens to be. And I think having a kind of a no surprise leadership philosophy up, down, and all around certainly referenced and talked about in the book around how do you make decisions and how do you be transparent in decision making. It definitely really impacted me.
I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, HubSpot. Now, the new year might have you thinking ahead to what you want out of your career. So when you think about your success story, what do you actually picture? Is it retiring early with a beautiful view of the skyline? Is it leaving a legacy with your name on it? Or maybe it's helping influence and change some of the world's most pressing issues. Whatever it is, writing your success story starts by working smart. Because when you work smart, your success story writes itself. A HubSpot CRM platform helps your marketing campaigns work harder and smarter. With intuitive visual workflows and bot builders, you can create scalable automated campaigns across email, social media, web, and chat so your customers hear your messages loud and clear. Are you tired of your content not adapting to mobile, making it difficult for your customers to absorb your message? A HubSpot CRM platform optimizes your content for multiple devices so that you can reach your customers wherever they are, which is just smart. Learn more about how you can transform your customer experience with a HubSpot CRM at HubSpot.com. You've been in so many different CEO roles and positions, and this is sort of how you've built out this framework, I guess. And I want to understand, like, when you wrote Decide and Conquer, what is that meant to be? Who's this book for? What's it trying to teach? Is it for another CEO? Is it for somebody who's up and coming in their career who wants to maybe do due diligence on the company they could be joining? Who's the reader?
Great question. The reader is for both leaders and aspiring leaders, is what I would say. If you don't have an interest in ever being a leader, it's really not a book for you. And what I found is that there's a number of principles that exist out there, because as a leader, you're making like hundreds of decisions every single day. Even deciding not to make a certain decision and to empower someone to make a decision is definitely a decision, right? So you're making 100 decisions a day. And what I wanted to is, I always wanted to kind of write a book. I teach at Columbia, so I love kind of teaching and education. And it was always been important to me, but I didn't want to write in these boring, like, you know, textbook kind of books with just like the five principles, this, the six principles, that, whatever kind of stuff. I wanted it to be a story where that was riveting. And through the storytelling, you end up kind of learning a ton around kind of smart decisions that you could ultimately make to become more successful. So it's for that audience. And, you know, things like, how do you think about whether a decision is a trapdoor decision, meaning you can't change it, which most people think many decisions are trapdoor decisions, when in fact you can change lots. You can't change, like, whether you're gonna, after you have a kid, like, that's a trapdoor decision. But most decisions are incredibly changeable, and people are so fearful of oftentimes making decisions because they think they're trapdoor decisions when they're actually not. And just other elements of decision making. So, you know, that's what we did. And the story under WeWork was so insane and such a roller coaster experience. And made for just some pretty crazy material.
I was going to say, so I feel like, and like, obviously you're on the inside, so I'm just going to speak like as a layman on the outside. I feel like WeWork is not the epitome of great leadership decision-making.
You learn from what not to do just as much as you learn what to do. Yes.
So you've been, how many like, chief executive roles have you held over your career?
Well, I would say this is my third president or CEO or CEO role. And if you include general management positions, then it's my fifth.
So what is, out of, obviously you have some experience with this. So what is the definition of a leader in a business context? And what is the most important trait for a leader?
Oh, wow. Okay. So let's go backwards. The most important trait for a leader, from my perspective, is understanding that your role is to enable the success of everyone around you, is to think about the reverse organizational chart, where like the leader is on the bottom of the chart, not at the top. Your role is to support and enable the success of all the executives. And the executive's role is to support and enable the success of their managers, and manager's role to enable the success of individuals. My role is not to succeed myself. I don't need to succeed myself. I need to enable the different people on my team to succeed. And guess what? Then I succeed. But that's my job, is to enable everyone else to succeed around me and do whatever is necessary. Sometimes it means letting go of people to enable them to succeed, actually. To me, that is the most important role of a leader. Support the success of those around you.
Now, I agree with what the role of the leader is. And I want to understand your opinion about how to do this tactically when there's interests of other parties that maybe prompt different decision making. So for example, when you were acquired at Investopedia, obviously stakeholders. There were certain stakeholders that were making that decision because they thought it was for the benefit of those stakeholders or even shareholders. But in a business environment, how do you align that leadership principle, which I agree with the expectations of shareholders, for example, or owners or whatnot? Because that's a fundamental thing that I think I always see causing conflict. Everybody agrees what a good leader is, but nobody knows how to do it when their board and their owners feel the need to do things differently, for example, that obviously drive ROI or whatever that metric is, right?
Good. Okay, so to me, the golden rule is all about transparency. Meaning, if I am told by my parent company or by my board, transparently, you're not doing a good enough job, you need to focus on this, not that, et cetera, I transmit that information to someone else, it aligns interests in a lot more effective way than if information is withheld. The biggest challenge oftentimes, and why there's lots of misalignment like you're referring to, Scott, is because a board will have access to certain information, like, oh, a company wants to go public, or whatever the or we want to sell this company, whatever the incentive is for the board. And the management team or the employees have a completely different incentive. And then there's tension and there's problems because people there's asymmetrical access to information. The more that a leader can ensure that there's as consistent information as possible, so that the most junior person and the board member knows the same thing, the better. And you could say, oh, David, that's unrealistic. We share all of our financials with every employee. Our board does not know any information that every single employee does not know and get access to. Is there a risk in doing so? Can that employee take screenshots of like our financials and post them on wherever? Reddit? Yeah, they can. And there's a risk. But the reward of having alignment and incentives and priorities because you're brutally transparent is, you know, the way to go. And it goes with managing someone. You need to be transparent. If someone's not doing a great job, it's not nice to them, not kind to them to like say, don't worry, keep it up, everything will be okay, and then surprise them later on. Kind of the kindest thing you could do is give very critical, transparent, maybe overly blunt in order to be clear information in as respectful a way as possible. So transparency to me is like the end all be all.
This is like radical candor.
There you go.
That's
true.
Yeah.
At our company, we have like a book. We had a book club. And radical candor was one of the books in the book club. Yes.
Yeah. I have no doubt it was. It's a great leadership philosophy. So, and this is what you're doing. This is one of the principles.
And Scott, can I just tell you one other thing about it?
Yeah.
If you don't mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
no, it's your show, man. You say whatever you want.
It's your show, dude. It's not my show, but like, I'm still going to like say it. So
go for it.
There's one of the most famous managers leaders ever. In fact, he won Time Magazine's Manager of the Century for the 20th century. Wow. Was Jack Welch, the CEO of GE, General Electric, for 20 years. At the time that he left, the highest market cap company in the world. He was on IAC's board, and I got to sit down with him and meet with him one-on-one. And I said to Jack Welch, you were the manager of like the century. What can you teach me about management, like on one foot? And he's like, just focus on transparency, focus on trust. If you build transparency, you'll have trust. And if you have trust, you could have anything. Make sure you have trust of your employees, trust of your board, trust of your team. That's all. That's the most important thing. So that had an impact too.
It's amazing because it seems like that runs counter to almost every company operating out there that seems to hide everything from their employees. So there's always like the large companies that have probably been around for a long time that operate the way that they feel like they have to, you know, hide everything. And you don't know what the next person in the cubicle beside you is making, let alone what the company's financials are like, unless they're public. But outside of that, you also have the startup that's worried about sharing information because they may not have a run rate longer than 6 months. So it's a very scary feeling, but yeah, go ahead. No, go ahead.
If you're a startup and you don't have a run rate of more than 6 months, I know that's scary. So you get the team together and you say, okay, who do you know? What angels do you know? Or let's be aligned. We got to reduce our costs. Well, how can we focus on our hosting costs? What do we need to do to reduce costs? Just get everyone aligned, or else people are like, why are they asking us to reduce our... And people just start jumping to conclusions. And frankly, usually those conclusions that they jump to, those assumptions that people are far worse than the actual truth that's actually going on, except in WeWork's case. The truth was actually worse than WeWork. But for many companies, it's not.
Okay, so let's talk about some things that you're doing. So let's talk about, this is an interesting way of doing it. Let's talk about some of the principles that you speak about in the book outside of trust and communication, not to say those are not like incredibly important, but there's other ones in there. There's like a lot. I think there's like 44? Is it 44 or a lot of decisions?
There's a lot of decisions,
A lot of decisions and concepts in there. So whatever, we won't be doing 44 or whatever it is today.
I hope not, but for your listeners.
Yeah, I know. I got to have like lunch eventually and whatnot, but let's pick a couple others. And I think that what would be great is if you pick your, like your favorites, talk about the concept and why it's important. And then I think it's really great if you speak about how you've done it in Meetup, because there's the theory and then there's the very tactical, and people love the theory, but it's really good to see it executed in an actual successful company. So that's great too. So let's do that.
Ooh, you've done this before, I think. Damn, that's a good question.
A few times.
Okay, sorry. As my wife says, I crack myself up. It's terrible.
Good. I laugh at my own jokes too. She hates
it. It's so annoying to her. Oh my God. Yeah. Okay. So I think the one that I also, we talked about a few, just to remind people of the ones we've talked about so far, and then I'll share a new one. The ones we've talked about so far are be surprised only about being surprised. That's kind of one. Another one is focus on being kind, not necessarily being nice. A third one is focus on creating options for yourself rather than limiting options in your decision-making. So the next one that I'll share is around decision-making biases. So there are many major biases that we all have, and I'll name a few of them. And the key is to understand how you are biased, because it's not a question of whether you're biased or not biased. You're biased. We are all influenced by these biases. So here's an example of three or four different biases, and then you could choose one out and then we'll talk about it. So first one, recency bias. So recency bias is the concept that if you had 10 data points, is that last data point that's usually gonna have a way over influence on how you perceive something and the decision you end up making. So the example I like to give around that is yoga could be exhausting. I love yoga and you're stretching all over the place, but at the end you do a shavasana and you're chill and you're relaxed. And that's what you remember most, that like shavasana feeling. So you want to go back to yoga because you did that shavasana at the end. You have that recency bias. Or the work experience I would give to that, because as you had asked for, was oftentimes there'll be an executive that's not working out. And you need to, unfortunately, let that executive go. Hopefully, you've given enough critical feedback during that process. And that executive is too extreme in one direction. The executive is too aggressive or not aggressive enough or whatever the challenge happens to be. You end up hiring the next person just as the opposite of the person who had just happened to have been there. When in reality, there's could be 10 different factors that are important in an executive. Great communicator, domain knowledge base, great hire of talent, whatever those four or five things happen to be. But because they skew really extreme in a challenge in one way, you go the exact opposite direction because of that recency bias in hiring that next person. And that's oftentimes a mistake. You have to recognize that you have this recent bias that you're going to end up trying to overly compensate for and not let that bias overly influence the next decision that you're going to be making. If that makes sense.
It does 100%. That's smart. Very smart. So we have biases. So we can go through a few more.
Sure.
I'll let you lead. You know which ones, you know which ones are sort of like that. That's a great one, by the way. But you know which ones are the ones that come up again.
Yeah,
and again,
I'll give three more biases that people have in decision making.
That's fair.
So
let's do it.
The next one I would say is confirmation bias, which is, you know, things are going great. So you're going to keep looking at the data as long as it's going great. And then when things aren't going so well, you don't really look at that information. You're looking for just things that confirm what you want to see, as opposed to seeking out different opinions of others that can actually help you to make a smarter decision. If you surround yourself by people who are just confirming, you ain't going to be making a smart decision. The key to actually great decision-making is disagreement and debate. And the more disagreement and debate that you have, the less confirmation bias you're going to have, the better decision you're ultimately going to make. So I'll give you an example of what we do at actually a bunch of my different companies, but certainly at Meetup, which is when we come into a meeting, we don't just come into the meeting and talk about something. Prior to the meeting, we have someone create a Google Doc. And in that Google Doc, they'll put a specific opinion out there and they'll share that opinion with everyone in the meeting. And then we expect everyone who's before the meeting to give their opinions and disagreements in that document. And then when we have the meeting itself, it's a discussion of where there's areas of disagreement in order to then figure out how to align on those and not spending time where already we agree on something. And, you know, because that's kind of a waste of time. What it also does is it gives people who are more introverted an opportunity to really participate as effectively as people who are extroverted, because this asynchronous time where individuals can share their opinions to help to influence decisions, not necessarily in the room, but in a document. And that helps with increasing debate and disagreement and reducing confirmation bias.
Very smart. I know a lot of entrepreneurs listen to this show, and NetSuite has been a huge supporter for entrepreneurs, for business owners, because there's one thing that we all know. Business is about making money, and it's about your bottom line. And the less you spend on the nuts and bolts of running your business, the more profits you keep. But these days, everything is costing more. Supplies, people, shipping. It squeezes your margins, and I've been there, juggling multiple systems for finance, inventory, you name it. Each with its own costs and its own set of headaches. That's why I made the switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's changed our company. Think about it. NetSuite is one of the top financial systems out there. It puts your whole business on one platform, accounting, finance, the works. One data source for everyone. There's no more mismatched info. And because it's in the cloud, it slashes your IT costs. No more servers, no more updates. Just access NetSuite from anywhere. With one integrated suite, your overhead drops big time. And here's the real win. Efficiency. Everything's connected in NetSuite. Costs are ridiculous lately. Find a proven way to reduce your expenses and get better performance out of your team. It's a no-brainer, and that's what NetSuite offers. Over 37,000 companies have figured this out already. You have to join them. Right now, through to April 15th, NetSuite's got an incredible, flexible financing plan. Check it out and see the savings yourself at netsuite.com/ScottClary. That's netsuite.com/ScottClary. Just a quick question. Have you ever had one of those oh no moments when you realize that you accidentally deleted a huge file? Or worse, your whole computer dies. I know I have. It's happened to me a lot, but don't sweat it. The sponsor of today's episode, Backblaze, they have your back. It is unlimited backups for all your Macs, your PCs, or even your whole company, and it's really affordable, under $100 a year. If you're running a business, they take the stress out of protecting everyone's data. If you need more bells and whistles for compliance, so on and so forth, they have enterprise options too. Honestly, losing data sucks, but Backblaze makes getting it back easy. They have restored billions of files. They offer tons of restore options, including rapid recovery in an event of data loss or ransomware. And you can access your backed up data from everywhere and anywhere in the world using their web app, iOS, or Android apps. It's been recommended by the New York Times, Inc., Macworld, PC World, LifeWire, Wired, Tom's Guide, 9to5Mac, and tons more. And best, you can try it fully featured with no risk at backblaze.com/story. They set up that link for all Success Story podcast listeners. That is a no-risk free trial at backblaze.com/story. Seriously, back up your stuff. I don't know about you, but the idea of being harassed, scammed, or even worse, all because somebody found my personal information online, that's terrifying. Our political opinions, our addresses, even stuff about our families, it's out there for anyone to grab. And did you know that data brokers are allowed to sell information on over 98% of Americans? It's scary stuff. That's why I've partnered with Delete Me. I personally use Delete Me. They're a big friend of the podcast because I put myself out there online. So safety is a huge concern. It's really scary how easy it is to find someone's details and information, but Delete Me creates a layer of protection that we all need. You tell Delete Me what you want gone, and they make it disappear from those sketchy data broker sites. And Delete Me doesn't stop. They constantly monitor the web to keep your information off those lists. It's like having a privacy watchdog that never sleeps. You need to take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. They're giving a special discount for all Success Story podcast listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/success and use promo code success at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/success and enter code success at checkout. joindeleteme.com/success. Today's show is brought to you by 1Password. Now listen, we all have that one friend who's constantly forgetting passwords and needing help to get into their accounts. I have a solution. It's called 1Password. 1Password is the award-winning password manager trusted by millions of users and companies like IBM and Slack to keep logins, credit cards, and other private info safe in an encrypted vault that only you can access. No more sticky notes with passwords or using the same password everywhere. I've been using 1Password for a year now, and I can't recommend it enough. It saves me time from having to reset passwords and gives me peace of mind knowing my info is secure. With convenient features like automatic password generation and login autofill, 1Password takes the hassle out of passwords. You can use it on all your devices, iOS, Android, Mac, PC. Everything syncs seamlessly. And with top-notch security audits and encryption, your data stays private. So do yourself a favor and check out 1Password today. Go to 1Password.com/Clary and get a 2-week free trial. Let 1Password remember all of your logins for you so you can remember what really matters. That's 1Password.com/Clary for 2 weeks free. Hey everyone, I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond Bourbon. Now, I don't have a lot of liquor sponsors on this show. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is actually one of my favorites. I've drank it for a few years now, and this is why we actually decided to work together. Heaven Hill Distillery, family-owned since 1935, is a great entrepreneur story too. So there's five brothers. They filled their first whiskey barrels back in 1935, and their legacy still lives on today. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is aged over 7 years. That's three more than required by the Bottled and Bond Act of 1897. This means the best quality, the best purity, and the best consistency. This is not just average bourbon. It's the winner of the double gold medals at multiple 2023 World Spirits competitions, and they've won the very prestigious Triple Still Award. It's a very big deal in the liquor and bourbon world. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond boasts an exceptionally smooth oak flavor, while its aroma offers a sweet blend of caramel and smooth vanilla. If you love bourbon, you need to try Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond. Available nationally, look for a bottle at your local store. Heaven Hill reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Smart. Okay. Good. Do you have two more?
Yeah. Okay. Two more. I'll do them quick. So one is status quo.
You keep pausing, and I'm like, listen, man, I just didn't get the smart idea. I'm just taking mental notes. I don't have anything else to add on to it. You're the expert here. I'm just going to do it in my next meeting. I'm like, yeah, that's a pretty damn good idea.
Okay. You should. It really does work, and it's just very efficient, actually, too. Status quo bias is the next one, which is just people's fear of change, and just people are oftentimes prefer to have the status quo, even if it sucks and it's terrible and they're miserable and they're unhappy, than the fear of the unknown that could be potentially worse, even though it's likely going to be better. And kind of helping people to understand that you need to pivot careers, you need to pivot businesses, pivoting is essential to survival, and status quo is just something that's incredibly dangerous as part of many people's biases. And then the last one, so I won't even give you a chance to comment on this one. The last one around biases that I find happening oftentimes is around sunk cost fallacy, which on a personal note for me is things like, I go to an expensive restaurant, I order lots of food, I feel sick because I ate all the food, but of course I had to eat all the food because I paid for it. When in reality, the goal was like, enjoy yourself and like leave over some food. But a lot of people don't appreciate that you, if you already did something, it's a sunk cost. If you already invested millions of dollars into a business, too often people will say, well, look how much we invested. It'll look so bad. We can't, you know, jettison that business. When in reality, it's gone. It's over. Bye-bye $2 million you just invested. What is the right decision at this time? How do you divorce kind of emotional connections to these costs that you had put in so that you make a smarter decision moving forward?
Now, you have these biases that you have to be cognizant and aware of, which is very smart. Once you're aware of these, what's your decision-making process once you are aware of your biases?
Find as many people to disagree. And if you don't have tension or disagreement, then you probably haven't thought about all the different angles and challenges that could be in front of you. And only then...
How do you do that?
How do you do that?
I was going to say... especially because unless you have an extreme amount of psychological safety in your organization, people are not comfortable.
But you nailed it. You nailed it right there. I mean, you need to create an environment where people understand that the best thing that they could do to quote unquote look good and to help is to actually disagree. I have people on my team who will say things like, I don't know if I even agree or disagree with my disagreement about to say, but I'm going to disagree now because I know that that's actually helpful in the decision-making process. And the key is that when someone does disagree, you have to hold that up to a high, you have to say, thank you. You are so right. The moment that I, as a leader, become defensive when someone's disagreeing is the moment that you're kiboshing the ability for people to feel safe and to disagree. And then what you're kiboshing, essentially, I've never said that word twice in whatever sentence, then what you're kiboshing is the ability to actually make smart decisions, which is a serious problem since kind of life and business are all about kind of one decision after another.
And as a leader, do you hire for that particular personality? Is that something that you look for when you bring a new exec or anybody on?
I can't say about anybody. I would love to say anybody. I would love to say that because I'm not interviewing. I'm interviewing my reports or sometimes the reports of my direct reports. And we do have values that we do interview for, like embracing change is a value that we interview for. And that's actually helpful. We have 6 specific values at Meetup that we interview for. But for people that are on my team, I do look for disagreement a lot. And I would say that there is a certain level of self-esteem, confidence, but not cockiness, that's really important for people. Because if you lack self-esteem and you're scared to share your voice, then it's harder to disagree. My job is to then figure out how to get that disagreement out of you, because some people are more introverted and less comfortable doing that. And I'll then try to talk to people in one-on-one sessions and invite disagreement because I know some people in a group setting are less apt to disagree. And my job again is, what can I do to help people on my team and others to feel as comfortable as possible? And that's just creating that kind of environment where you are praised for being contrary, but you also need to, at a certain point, obviously, be the appropriate soldier, not just continue to be contrary for contrary's sake either.
Very smart. And a lot of the things that we just spoke about, they're things that you have to work on internally. But you also mentioned something that I thought was a little interesting. You mentioned when you're hiring an executive, and I assume it would be for you as a CEO as well, what are the top skills, like the hard skills? So is it hiring? Is it domain expertise? What is the list of things that you look for in people that you're looking to bring in at an upper level?
Great. I'll say the things that I look for and also list a couple of things that people look for, but it's actually, I think, less important than people realize. And it's because one of the things I like to talk about is deprioritization is more important than prioritization. You could say like these 10 things are really important, what you're looking for, that's not helpful. It's here are the things that are not important, actually, or less important than people realize. So I'll start with the less important one. Actually, you hit on it there. Domain expertise. Now, I'm not saying that our head of marketing shouldn't be very strong in marketing. Obviously, she's amazing at marketing and very important. However, I would rather have someone who is an 8.5 or 9 out of 10, in 8.5 out of 10 even, in domain expertise and is great at hiring people underneath them, is a phenomenal communicator, is a strong team player, is highly analytical. All those things are much more important than kind of years of experience or having been there, done that, because you could learn things from other people and you don't need to be the absolute expert in many things. So that's something that I think people actually over-prioritize. They also over-prioritize things like what company someone worked at or what school mm-hmm. someone went to. All that stuff is just such BS and, you know, way over-prioritized brand names. The things that I tend to prioritize the most are trying to understand kind of the level of selfishness versus unselfishness of a potential team member. When someone has a ego-driven, deeply selfish approach to the way in which they approach business, and you can ascertain that, I'll tell you how I tend to ascertain that. I don't want that person on the team, no matter what, no matter what. So what I tend to do is I do zero reference checking, zero. You might be like, what? How could you not do reference checking? It's kind of important. You can't learn much. All I do is back channeling. So I never ask someone for like 3, 4, or 5 people that I should talk to, because they're only going to give me like the great people. They're going to tell me people that like think they're the bee's knees or whatever. Bee's knees are good. I don't even know what those are. But instead, I am LinkedIn with like 30,000 people. So I can always find someone. So I find someone else who I'm connected to the person. And then I just reach out and I back channel the heck out of any potential hire. And it's kind of served me well. And we pulled back from potential hires based on the back channeling as well. Because then you get the, you know, the unfiltered and transparent truth.
What is back channeling?
Oh, I'm sorry. Explain that to me. Back channeling is basically just, if I'm thinking of hiring Michael, then I don't say to Michael, hey, who should I talk to from your past that is good? I go on LinkedIn. I look who's connected to Michael. I reach out to those people that have worked with Michael in the past.
You just ask them.
I say, hey, did you work with Michael? I didn't work that closely. Okay. Can you refer me to someone who did work closely with Michael in the organization? Oh yeah, of course. Janine worked really close with Michael. Great. Do you mind making an introduction to Janine? Sure. And then I talk to Janine about Michael.
And you just see what the average, you know, the average view of somebody who just, you know, worked a couple hours a day with this person, how they treated other people, what I got it. That's smart. Very, very smart. And I'm also curious, this can be like the final question. Then I like to do a couple rapid fire, but we've been going for a bit now, but I like to understand people's frameworks for things. So you said you like to deprioritize, and that's more important than prioritizing. So how do you, cause there's a million different ways to do that. Like the urgent, important, the Eisenhower matrix, all the different ways to, you know, to figure it out. So how do you do it? How do you deprioritize things?
Yeah, I try to have as objective a basis as possible in deprioritizing opportunities. So the challenge is that many startups and leaders, they die more of overeating than of starvation. You know, they try on too many different things at the same time and they can't prioritize. So I try to quantify as much as possible. So every opportunity I'll say, okay, let's put an assumption in there. How big is this market? What percentage do we think we get of the market? What are some examples of that? If we move this needle in terms of improving search on Meetup, and there was a 3% increase in the number of people who became organizers because we improved search, what's the dollar value of that? So what I try to do in prioritization, deprioritization is anything that potentially, not everything can be, but anything that could potentially be quantifiable, we push hard to make it as quantifiable as possible. And then it's oftentimes becomes more obvious of like, why? I know you think this would be great, but why would we prioritize this when this other opportunity has like 10x the potential value? And it takes things from opinions into a subjective into more objective, which then builds, you know, higher levels of alignment, you know, between different people around resources.
Very smart idea. Okay. In closing, any other points that you want to bring up? Floor is yours, but also if not, and it's okay if there are, but if not, what do you want people to take away after they've read this book? What do you want them to feel? What do you want them to learn? What's the goal?
I think the number one thing that I want people to take away after reading the book is their careers, their life, their future is more in their control than they may realize. I think too often people have an external locus of control and they say these things happen, it's unfortunate, and they blame kind of outside forces. And I think the book is kind of a story of lots of different experiences where I and others did things that were seemingly impossible, like getting Meetup to be acquired by someone who I knew from 20 years ago, even though there were 30 other companies that were looking to, you know, acquire Meetup out of WeWork, and persevered to make it a reality. That would be the greatest thing if people felt more ownership of what happens in their lives. To me, that's the biggest one.
Amazing. Okay. And if people want to get the book, connect with you, chat with you, where do they go? Social, website, all that.
Okay. So book's coming out March 8th. And you can get on a little bookseller that some people might have heard of called Amazon, as well as any other, you know, online bookselling place. We have a website. It's called decideandconquerbook.com. You can go to the website and you can check out stuff there. You know, just go on to any bookstore also will have it. And in terms of reaching me, LinkedIn is probably the best way. So you could easily find me, just David Siegel on Meetup. You can even send me an email, david@meetup.com. Just love to hear from anyone who is interested in the topics we're talked about.
Amazing. No, that's great. Okay. Let's do a couple of rapid fire. Biggest challenge you've overcome in your life. What was that challenge? How did you overcome it?
I was deathly afraid of public speaking. Sweaty palmed,
really
nervous as all hell.
Look at you now.
I know, right? And overcame it, just practice. It's just over and over and over again. And you just get less and less nervous, and then it just becomes second nature to you. So now I'm like public speaking in the shower. So, you know, it's real easy.
If you had to choose one person, obviously there's been many, but pick one person who's been highly influential in your life. Who was that person and what did they teach you?
Okay. So I decided to become decided. I set an ambition for myself to run a company because I saw someone who became my mentor. His name is David Rosenblatt. He's the CEO of First Dibs, and he's on the board of Twitter and IAC and a bunch of other amazing companies. And he just took me under his wing, and I used to meet with him weekly or every other week. And still 20 years later, whenever I have an important career decision to make, or life decision to make, not just career, but life decision to make, he's always there and he's always supportive of me. And you know, he's had a big influence on me and my family.
Amazing. A book, podcast, Audible, something that's helped you that you'd recommend people go check out.
Oh boy. Okay. It's an oldie, but a goodie. When I say oldie, I mean like really oldie. So it's controversial, but I'm going to go with Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People, written in like 1930 or something. And I teach a class and I have all my students, they have to read the class. And a lot of it is inappropriate, let's say, for our times. And it's unfortunately way, way too white male. However, there is such beautiful learnings in terms of helping to kind of build relationships that can last a lifetime. So if people have not read it, it's a classic. I always recommend it.
It is. And candidly, like, it was written in the 1930s.
Exactly. So understanding the time frame when it was written.
Definitely a different time. It's a different time for sure. If you could tell your 20-year-old self one thing, what would it be?
Don't care about money so much. Money will always come. Focus on what you want to, what you feel like you could be great at, and good things will come. Don't put so much pressure on yourself around that. It's just not that important. It's important up to a point. Past a point ain't that important.
And last question, what does success mean to you?
Success means happiness. That's it. Being a happy person. If you have a lot of money and you're unhappy, that's your failure, right? And if you want a family, not everyone necessarily wants one, but if you want a family and you have a wonderful family and you're happy in that family and that's the way that you want to live your life, to me, that's success.
I know a lot of entrepreneurs listen to this show, and NetSuite has been a huge supporter for entrepreneurs, for business owners, because there's one thing that we all know. Business is about making money, and it's about your bottom line. And the less you spend on the nuts and bolts of running your business, the more profits you keep. But these days, everything is costing more. Supplies, people, shipping. It squeezes your margins. And I've been there, juggling multiple systems for finance, inventory, you name it. Each with its own costs and its own set of headaches. That's why I made the switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's changed our company. Think about it. NetSuite is one of the top financial systems out there. It puts your whole business on one platform, accounting, finance, the works. One data source for everyone. There's no more mismatched info. And because it's in the cloud, it slashes your IT costs. No more servers, no more updates. Just access NetSuite from anywhere. With one integrated suite, your overhead drops big time. And here's the real win. Efficiency. Everything's connected in NetSuite. Costs are ridiculous lately. Find a proven way to reduce your expenses and get better performance out of your team. It's a no-brainer, and that's what NetSuite offers. Over 37,000 companies have figured this out already. You have to join them. Right now, through to April 15th, NetSuite's got an incredible, flexible financing plan. Check it out and see the savings yourself at netsuite.com/Scott Clary. That's netsuite.com/Scott Clary. Just a quick question. Have you ever had one of those oh no moments when you realize that you accidentally deleted a huge file? Or worse, your whole computer dies. I know I have. It's happened to me a lot, but don't sweat it. The sponsor of today's episode, Backblaze, they have your back. It is unlimited backups for all your Macs, your PCs, or even your whole company. And it's really affordable, under $100 a year. If you're running a business, they take the stress out of protecting everyone's data. If you need more bells and whistles for compliance, so on and so forth, they have enterprise options too. Honestly, losing data sucks, but Backblaze makes getting it back easy. They have restored billions of files. They offer tons of restore options, including rapid recovery in an event of data loss or ransomware. And you can access your backed up data from everywhere and anywhere in the world using their web app, iOS, or Android apps. It's been recommended by the New York Times, Inc., Macworld, PC World, LifeWire, Wired, Tom's Guide, 9to5Mac, and tons more. And best, you can try it fully featured with no risk at backblaze.com/story. They set up that link for all Success Story podcast listeners. That is a no-risk free trial at backblaze.com/story. Seriously, back up your stuff. I don't know about you, but the idea of being harassed, scammed, or even worse, all because somebody found my personal information online, that's terrifying. Our political opinions, our addresses, even stuff about our families, it's out there for anyone to grab. And did you know that data brokers are allowed to sell information on over 98% of Americans? It's scary stuff. That's why I've partnered with Delete Me. I personally use Delete Me. They're a big friend of the podcast because I put myself out there online. So safety is a huge concern. It's really scary how easy it is to find someone's details and information, but Delete Me creates a layer of protection that we all need. You tell Delete Me what you want gone, and they make it disappear from those sketchy data broker sites. And Delete Me doesn't stop. They constantly monitor the web to keep your information off those lists. It's like having a privacy watchdog that never sleeps. You need to take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. They're giving a special discount for all Success Story podcast listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/success and use promo code success at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/success and enter code success at checkout. joindeleteme.com/success.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey everyone, I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond Bourbon. Now, I don't have a lot of liquor sponsors on this show. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is actually one of my favorites. I've drank it for a few years now, and this is why we actually decided to work together. Heaven Hill Distillery, family-owned since 1935, is a great entrepreneur story too. So there's five brothers. They filled their first whiskey barrels back in 1935, and their legacy still lives on today. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is aged over 7 years. That's three more than required by the Bottled and Bond Act of 1897. This means the best quality, the best purity, and the best consistency. This is not just average bourbon. It's the winner of the double gold medals at multiple 2023 World Spirits competitions, and they've won the very prestigious Triple Still Award. It's a very big deal in the liquor and bourbon world. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond boasts an exceptionally smooth oak flavor, while its aroma offers a sweet blend of caramel and smooth vanilla. If you love bourbon, you need to try Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond. Available nationally, look for a bottle at your local store. Heaven Hill reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.